Blog Talk Radio. Novel in the award-winning series about a former nun in Tudor England, a haunting debut about a crime in small-town America, and the first standalone novel by a best-selling romance author. Those are books we feature on tonight's Literary New England radio show. I'm your host, Cindy Wolf Boynton, and stay with me, please, for author interviews and book giveaways as I talk with Linda Goodnight on The Memory House. It's Linda's first standalone novel where two wounded people, a man and a woman, come together at an inn in Tennessee and are enveloped by long-dead ghosts of a Civil War romance.
Life is hard, and so I want to write fiction that encourages people. And so when they get to the end of my book and they close that cover, they feel better. They feel hope.
I also talk with Emma Walsh on his stunning debut, My Sunshine Away, a novel set in the late 1980s that involves a teen raped just yards from her front door, a boy who has a crush on her who tries to solve the crime, the secrets that hide behind seemingly innocent white picket fences, and a memory from Emma's own childhood.
When I was young, I don't even remember the age, really young, I overheard my mom just telling a story about a girl in our neighborhood that it happened to.
We'll start things off talking with Nancy Bilyeu, whose The Tapestry is the final installment in her Tudor-era trilogy, which also includes The Crown and The Chalice. It's no secret that I've loved this series that actually is pretty hard to define. Like the books before it, The Tapestry is part thriller, part mystery, part romance, but all wonderfully written, clever, historical fiction that focuses on the young, willful Dominican nun novice Joanna Stafford. And I hate the idea that The Tapestry means saying goodbye.
I'm not going to say that I won't go back to Joanna. I feel like she's part of my family.
In The Tapestry, it's time for Joanna to face off with the individual who's ultimately responsible for her misery, her cousin, King Henry VIII. I couldn't wait to get my hands on a copy. And one of the first things I noticed was that, similar to Deborah Harkness's Discovery of Witches series or J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter books, each of Nancy's books in the series have gotten longer, meatier.
It gets a little bigger in scope. Yes, that's what I was trying for. I was trying to not just literally have her solving mysteries in each book. It's not really that kind of a series. It is more like a Deborah Harkness, or dare I say, J.K. Rowling, where you have an overall journey that the character is on. And in my books, in the third, she gets some answers to some of the questions and some of the challenges that she's had all along.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in The Tapestry, so please tell us about this book.
Well, the first two books, the first book, The Crown, Joanna is in her priory, the only Dominican priory in England, which is a real place, and I set a fictional character in this priory, and she is very committed to her life there, but this is the reign of Henry VIII, and he is breaking with Rome, and as part of that, he is destroying the monasteries. So the whole premise of my books is a woman's struggle to find a place for herself. Yeah. Joanna felt like this would be the place that she would fit in. She doesn't feel she fits in other parts of her society, and yet this has been taken away from her. So there are mysteries, there are conspiracies, there are real people. I put Henry VIII, Stephen Gardner, Thomas Cromwell. It's funny, these are the same people we're seeing in Wolf Hall in
sure.
my books. But it really is her struggle and her challenge, and so it created this character who's, you know, sometimes she's learning things that are interesting, sometimes she's fighting for her life. So it runs the gamut. And the third one, from the very beginning, I had Joanna as being talented at tapestry weaving. That is a fantastic art form. The Renaissance tapestries, extremely expensive, woven with gold and silk threads, literally. Henry VIII was the number one collector of these tapestries in Europe. He spent more than anyone else. He spent more than a warship on one set of tapestries. He was obsessed. So,
get out of here.
No, he did. He had more than...
More than a warship?
Yes. He had 2,000 tapestries when he died. They did an inventory. He was like that. He was an obsessive collector and builder. He built all of these extraordinarily expensive palaces, some of which he never lived in. And we all know he collected women to a certain extent.
Yes.
And but a lot of people don't know about the tapestries, and they were almost all made in Brussels. And you know, capitalism was alive and well. This whole culture in Brussels sprang up because of the monarchs of England, Henry, the Emperor Charles, King Francis of France, competing with each other to get the most beautiful tapestries. And because they were outbidding each other and trying to outmaneuver each other, the prices just kept soaring. So one in five men in Brussels in the 1540s worked in the tapestry industry. So this all just sprang up, and they had guilds, they had rules. It's this whole world. Now, Joanna is doing it on a much lesser extent with the nuns in the beginning, but she has a true talent and a true vision for making a tapestry, and Henry VIII being an extremely discerning collector, and I base that on documents, on truth, not just making that up. And the third book, my premise is these two finally have their showdown. She's been so afraid of him and hating him because he's had killed people who meant a lot to her, and he's demolished the spiritual way of life that meant everything to her. But in the third one, he summons her, and for various reasons, she has to go to Whitehall. And so the premise of the third is what happens when these two finally have their emotional and, you know, cultural confrontation. And there's all these other things going on, too. 1540 was a very violent and hugely seismic changing time in Henry VIII's reign. You're thinking, oh yeah, well of course he kills people all the time, but this was the year that Cromwell went down and he switched wives, and a lot happened. People focus a lot on the Anne Boleyn death and all of that transformation. 1540, because people knew what the stakes were, it was even more frightening, because you knew that if you were on the wrong side, you would definitely be killed, which you didn't know earlier. So I throw her into this. She also has her personal journeys where, you know, people who mean a lot to her, she has to decide what kind of life she wants and what kind of relationship she's going to have with these people. Remember my book? My second book won the Romantic Times Reviewers Award, which
yes.
I think is so funny because it's purely sexual tension, yet it, you know, so I'm very pleased that among all the more explicit romances, it could win an award. So there is that aspect, too. It's not just a theological book, and they're not just pure page-turners. There's also a lot of emotion.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, you know that I am a huge fan of your books and Joanna Stafford.
Oh, I love it.
and you know what? She's a very real woman. I mean, the fact that she is a novice or has been a novice doesn't take away any aspect of her womanhood, for sure. And she's dealing with love and family issues and desire just like anybody else.
That's right. And some of the nuns who I've researched and met in, you know, obviously our time, are very, you know, they own up to these sorts of feelings and emotions. You know, they've chosen this path, you know, which is departing from that pursuit of your life. But that doesn't mean that they don't have these feelings or that they don't have to deal with it too. And in this case, you know, Joanna Stafford's in a very special circumstance because all of the nunneries have been destroyed. All of the nuns have been ejected with small pensions. Now, King Henry VIII, also in Book Two, there is a true law that went through Parliament, I did not concoct it, that all of the people who had taken vows of celibacy as nuns and monks must keep those vows for the rest of their lives or face a punishment of hanging.
Yeah, so, that's so ridiculous.
Yes, so it was just so typical of his complete unreasonableness and dictatorial, you know, almost totalitarian nature of his court that we're going to stop you from becoming a nun, but you can't get married. And here's a tiny pension that you won't be able to live on. It was very, very hard.
Well, you know, I don't think that you know, Henry VIII doesn't come across as a very nice guy, certainly, in any of your books. I don't think he comes across as a tyrant, however. But I think that one thing that I am learning more and more about him is he really was a tyrant. Like, he was a bastard. I think he was a serial killer.
I know. He's been, because of the six wives, and the fact that in reality he was an extremely handsome man in his youth, and we have these Hans Holbein murals. We have all these portraits where he's standing there with his hand on his hip, you know, legs astride, you know. He has this very almost sexy vibe in pop culture and in some historical fiction. And, you know, if you spend any time studying the real history, you see the tremendous cruelty that he actually was capable of, how he turned away from wives and ministers such as Cromwell. They never saw him when he decided to destroy them. They were never allowed to make a case or please themselves. In many cases, they didn't have trials. They were just annihilated. And it could happen just like that.
Well, you know what? One of the things that I wondered, and I'm about 3/4 of the way through the tapestry, and I'm just dying to know how it ends. But one of the things I'm surprised about is how long Anne of Cleves was around. I really thought that she was like in and out in a couple of weeks.
No, she married him because he was isolated. He had broken from the Catholic powers. And the Pope was egging on these powers in France and Spain to invade and take over the kingdom. And for different reasons, they didn't want to do it. For one thing, it's extremely expensive to invade a well-defended island kingdom. Henry VIII was under extreme danger. And so he had to marry one of the few countries that had anything to offer him that wouldn't reject him out of hand was a German country, because they were all going through the Protestant Reformation. So he married her, and as we all know, hated her almost immediately, just took this visceral dislike. Although you see the portraits, she definitely looks better than some of the wives he did love, like Jane Seymour. It's impossible to tell almost 500 years later what, you know, the reason could be for his disgust.
Sure.
But they got married, and the public did not know what we know at the time. And she actually made a very good impression as queen. And she was very dignified and really wanted to do a good job. She befriended her older stepchildren and was praised. She had a role to play, but the whole time he was trying to get rid of her. It's just, it took about 6 months. And then after that, he really did not want her to go back to her home country for reasons that no one's exactly clear on. I think he didn't want her brother, who was the ruler of Cleves then, to take too much offense. We don't know. But he really wanted her to stay in England after their divorce. As he said, you'll have the role of sister, and I will give you a huge amount of money and houses, and you'll live very comfortably. And she took him up on that. And she is actually the last of his wives to die. And she's the only one buried in Westminster. So she died in the reign of her stepdaughter Mary. Mary asked her to convert to Catholicism, and she did. She was always very agreeable to what people wanted. She was a very conforming person. And then she died. She died before her other stepdaughter, Elizabeth, came to power.
I went to her house a couple of years ago. Is it in, what is it, Lewes?
Yes. She had a few very nice houses.
Oh, she had more than one? Well, I thought it was adorable, and when I was there walking around it, I sat in the backyard, and I'm like, gosh, I would rather be on my own woman in this house than in that palace with him.
Well, you know, what happens today is everybody thinks she's the smart one because she got away, but the reality is that she was treated for melancholy at one point, and she actually, her ambassador approached him after the fifth wife died to be reinstated, because in that era, this was a very humiliating thing. And, you know, you couldn't then set up your own career and find a new hot guy. You know, after this happened, she lived with her servants and had almost no life except just going through the days, you know. And she had been groomed to be a queen, and she liked being queen. She liked officiating over a joust, and she liked receiving people. So even though she really made the best of it, I can't say that she was, you know, laughing all the way to the bank, which is the way we would say of like an Ivana Trump type situation today. Like, oh, smart, got all the money, and now she's partying. But, you know, it wasn't quite like that. But I do think the fact that she survived him, obviously, is preferable to the other option.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So now what's going to happen with you, Nancy? So you've written this fabulous trilogy. You've taken us back to this time of Henry VIII. You've made us fall in love with Joannis, and now it's over?
Well, I am toying with a few things. I love historical thrillers. I love writing them. So I have started another one, but it is not in the Tudor time. I'm going in a new direction now. And I'm not going to say that I won't go back to Joanna, because I feel like she's part of my family. But,
yeah.
You know, if people are responding to these books, they seem to, I had a million emails last night from a young woman in New Zealand who couldn't get it on Kobo, and I'm trying to help her. You know, I have to know. So, you know, I'm always open to the readers, and I like to communicate with them on Twitter and on emails and help them out. And I'm getting a lot of super response. I'm really excited. So it's possible, because I do have other ideas for her, that I will return. And I love this era passionately. The problem is that Tudor right now is sort of overheated. You know, there's so much going on. When I started these books 10 years ago, it was much quieter. So I feel like,
well,
you know, I
yes,
want to tell these
yes.
stories. I want to tell women's stories in a suspenseful, exciting, unique way. But it's not just confined to the 16th century. So I'm going to write other things. I already have something started, but it's not going to be with Joanna, with a Catholic novice at the center. Even though I have made real, I had a friar send me a CD of music. I have become like, it's so fun. Nuns and friars and monks and so forth are into it. They like the fact that there's one of their own. Solving mysteries and fighting the good fight in a series of novels. I can't tell you how much I love that.
I love that, Nancy. And I'm just thinking, you know, you're talking about this woman from New Zealand. It must be just an amazing feeling to have someone contact you from the other side of the world saying, you know, I've read your first two books. I have to find out what happens. You know, help me, help me.
I've had that. Yeah, I had a woman in Ireland who just was so upset. And it turned out, because she couldn't get the third one. And it turned out that someone at Amazon just hadn't flicked the switch for her part of Ireland, because, you know, it's not the United Kingdom, the part that she's in. I mean, you get into international law and treaties when you're doing these sorts of international publications. So I communicated with someone, they flicked the switch, she got the book, and then she tweeted this morning, because as you know, I'm on Twitter probably too much.
Yes.
I love it. She tweeted, housework and chores, dealing with family will not happen while I read the tapestry.
Oh, my God, that's awesome.
I know, I woke up to that because, of course, you know, whether it's New Zealand or England and Ireland, everybody's on a different time. So it's kind of like Joanna is happening 24/7. You know, there's always somebody reading it or communicating with me on different times. So, you know, which is really, it's so interesting to have this modern experience of dealing with readers and making sure that they have the book and hearing what they think about a story that was said in the 16th
yeah.
century. So it's kind of interesting how I almost feel like a time traveler sometimes.
Oh, hey, I like that. And I'm sure mentally you are, right? Mentally, you're in all different places.
When I was doing this, the third book, she goes to Whitehall, and everyone thinks they know what that means, but the actual palace that Henry VIII, Elizabeth, and then James I and Charles I were in burned to the ground. So I bought some books and that have studied the archaeology, done some digs, and I had to recreate, because they still have some of the palace now, the banqueting hall and so forth, and it was right by the Thames, right by Westminster, but it's actually not there.
That was on my list of places to go, and wasn't I shocked when I found out it didn't exist anymore?
I know. People just assume, oh, Whitehall, we all know what that is. But Whitehall means, you know, different things. And so what I did was, you know, on my kitchen table, I'm sort of recreating, here's where the jousts were, and here's where the king's chamber would, and here's where people on the Thames would get their boats to cross over to the Bishop Gardiner's palace for these rather racy banquets that you read about in the book. So, you know, I do, there's no question that I'm sort of submerging myself in these other worlds, and sort of what's happening in 2014, 2015 just recedes.
Well, you know, you say before, you know, you wonder if we're getting too much tutors. I don't know if we are, you know, and there are a lot of books out about the Tudors, the same thing like about the Titanic. There are a lot of books out about the Titanic. But you know what? Those of you who are able to make that period fresh and new, you keep calling us back again and again.
Oh, good. I know. Well, I have a lot of book blogger support, and I noticed like a few of them this time, because you know, they read so many books they're reviewing, and a few of them were saying, I'm so sick of the Tudors. It almost makes me sick to see another one. However, Nancy's doing something different. But there was this preface of, I can't take it much longer. And it's kind of, you know, in a way I feel like there's obviously a lot of other people who are interested in the same things I am of history. And that's cool. And I'm glad that I overcome, you know, the feeling of burnout with a very fresh story. And nobody else, to my knowledge, is doing this from the Catholic point of view. It's almost always from the other side, the Hilary Mantel, Wolf Hall point of view. But I'd like to, you know, also do a different era, different things that are more uncharted.
As you should, Nancy. So can you give us a hint of where you are in time or where you are continent-wise in this next book?
All I can tell you is part of the book, part of it is in the U.S. of A. Yes.
Oh, my God, I'm shocked.
I know. People just assume that I will never abandon my Anglophile ways. And but it's so amazing to have something that's that close where I don't have to go through all of these. It just almost seems too easy to find out what was happening, you know, here, you know, a couple centuries ago, as opposed to, you know, trying to recreate the lost monastic world. I mean, you know, I think I've written an article or two about this, but Blackfriars, which is an enormous complex of palaces of the friars of the Dominican Order, and it was so large that they could have parliament there. They could have feasts, banquets, an amazing place, libraries, beautiful art. It's completely demolished. All you have now are two gravestones in an obscure park. That's it. So that became, when I first started writing these books, I didn't realize how much of it was demolished and gone. That it was really almost like Atlantis. It was a lost world, the world of the monasteries in England. But then, you know, it became my special challenge, and I started to find books that were written maybe a century ago that had more access to more sources than we have now, and I started to really do tons of research on what life would have been like based on what a Dominican order was doing in France 100 years later. You know, so you go backwards, you go forwards, you recreate, and, you know, I have a nun who in Dominican order who was reading the books to make sure I didn't go off too far in the wrong directions. So, you know, it became, you know, an alternative universe, that's for sure. But it is fun. It's almost delightful to actually be able to research places that have not been demolished.
Yes. Well, I feel like you've given some hints, but I won't ask any more questions.
Give
and
me a
I
first.
Will keep
Give
it
me a first to be on the list.
Okay. Well, I wanna know. And actually, I could talk to you all morning, but we do need to wrap things up. And I bet you actually have some real work to do. But the tapestry. If someone hasn't read your earlier books, Nancy, do you feel that they have to read The Crown and The Chalice first?
No, you don't have to. People have been able to buy the third one by itself. What happens is they read it, and they because my editor and I work to sort of sneak in and always give you enough background so you know. But I think
you did a very skillful job, by the way.
I didn't want to make it totally dependent. But I think that it helps just to really appreciate some of the twists if you have read the earlier ones so you know just how much of a shock something is. So,
yeah, I think so too. And I was thinking about that a lot because I think that's always hard. And the books are, you know, her story is really an ongoing story. But you did truly, I think, a very skillful job weaving stuff in. So if someone didn't read the book, they can pick up what she went through.
A lot of what people think a series is really a number of books that have a recurring character. It's not the same as a true series where the action just keeps going. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Like if you have a recurring character who is a detective or solving a totally different crime in each book, there is absolutely no reason to read the earlier ones because it is completely interdependent. But I didn't do that. I set it up so that if you read the third one, you don't need to read the first two. But I think it's a richer experience to do the trilogy. And, you know, it's not like I'm saying, you have to read, like I'm George R.R. Martin, you have to have read six books to read the seventh. It's not that bad. So, but yeah, I wanted to do that. I wanted to continue some of the threads that I had started and tie them
up. I think everyone should read all three of your books, starting at the very beginning, because they will fall in love with Joanna. And they'll fall in love with you.
Oh, thank you. I love hearing from people after they've read my book. So, you know, anyone who has an opinion or has a point to make, you know, lay it on me.
Nancy, thank you so much for talking with
us
today.
This is great.
Win a copy of The Tapestry by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Do the same to win a copy of My Sunshine Away by M.O. Walsh, who credits New England's own and most beloved Stephen King for turning him on to reading. My Sunshine Away has gotten such great reviews. I was really eager to talk with M.O. about the book, but first I had to know exactly who I was talking with and what the M.O. in his name stood for.
My name is Milton O'Neill Walsh, and so I'm actually even a junior, so it's just my initials.
All right, I think initials always make me wonder.
Yeah, they're kind of mysterious.
They are mysterious. Are you a mysterious guy?
No, I don't think so. Just my grandfather always went by Milton, my dad went by O'Neill, and then people called me Neil, but when it came time to do the writing stuff, I kind of like to think about both my grandfather and my dad, so I just tried to combine it all.
Oh, I love that. See, now that's a beautiful story. I'm glad I asked that question. So now, this is your first published novel, right? You have written short stories, you've written essay, but My Sunshine Away is the first novel that's out there.
That's right. Yeah, my first one to finish. I had tried a couple, you know, that ran into some roadblocks and I could never quite get them done. But this was the first one that stuck, and I was able to see it all the way through. And I got lucky enough to, you know, find a publisher for it.
Yeah, and you've gotten great reviews. For anyone who hasn't heard of My Sunshine Away, please tell us, what's it all about?
Well, it's set in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, narrated by a man looking back at the summer of 1989, where he lived in a kind of, you know, grew up in a real kind of idyllic suburban neighborhood in one night in his youth, a girl that lived across the street was attacked and raped right there in the neighborhood when she was a young girl, 15 years old. And you find out he's talking about this primarily because he was 14 years old at the time and lived across the street from her and had an enormous crush on her at the time. And the book kind of opens up with you finding out that he was one of the suspects in this crime. And so he just kind of tells the story of that summer and the time that follows and the relationship they had, and tries to figure out, no one was ever arrested in it. So he kind of goes through the people that were also suspected of it.
So where did you get the idea from?
Well, the original idea kind of, came from my own life in terms of, the place I grew up and the neighborhood I grew up in. And when I was young, I don't even remember the age, really young, I overheard my mom just telling a story. I can't remember if she was on the phone with someone or talking to someone at the kitchen table, and I was just kind of walking through the room type of thing, but telling a story about a girl in our neighborhood that it happened to. And I was at an age where I had no idea, like, what that word meant at all. But I just remember this kind of sound in her voice, and it just really kind of stuck with me. I mean, I didn't think anything of it then other than, just that's a weird thing to hear. And I went outside and, played with my friends type of thing. But the older I got, when I would think back about my youth and, think so fondly of it, I just kept remembering this one story that I heard about that. And for some reason, that just seemed to kind of haunt me. And I one day just kind of sat down and wrote the first chapter of the book, just kind of with that premise, and then went from there. I mean, that's the part that's real. Everything else, the plot and everything else is made up. I mean, I have no idea who the actual girl was in the neighborhood. I never wanted to, find that out or anything. I just wanted to kind of explore it.
Sure. So was it difficult to go from writing short stories and essays to writing a novel? I mean, I know you've tried it before, but, what was it about this book that made you see it all the way through?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think it was difficult. I think, like, all writing is pretty difficult, and especially a novel. It's just really hard. I mean, it's I don't know. I just have so much respect for these people that keep finishing these things. They seem like these really tough puzzles for me. I mean, it took me like about 7 years altogether to finish it. And in some ways, having always written stories and essays made it kind of harder because I wasn't that familiar with plotting something that long. But in other ways, I think writing short stories for a long time really helped me because I just kind of always think of, every line should kind of be crucial in a short story and everything should be as tight as possible. And so I tried to take that approach with the chapters, so I think it helped me in that way. But I guess the reason I saw it through is like the only one that I never kind of got bored of. I never got, tired of. The challenge was always something that was real rewarding to me. And whenever I would have stretches where I wasn't working on the book, my wife and I had two children during the process of me writing this. I definitely wasn't writing every day, but I was thinking about it every day. And whenever I would be away from it for a while, I always kind of like felt bad for the characters. I kind of felt like I'd left them, kind of hanging out there. So I was always excited to get back to it.
So it really called to you.
Absolutely. I think partly because it's something I set in the town that I'm from. And so I had a lot of fun going back to that. The narrators of a similar age to mine, so I had a lot of fun going back to, late 80s and 90s and what it was like growing up in that time period. So, yeah, it definitely did. I mean, it felt, it felt deeply personal to me, and so I definitely wanted to keep going back to it.
Well, clearly you achieved something special. When you look at the reviews, I mean, things like it's the rarest of finds, or try to restrain yourself from flying through it, or Anne Rice saying, I am in awe, swept up in the quiet beauty of the prose. I mean, that it just has to be amazing to hear those kinds of things and to be coming from people like Anne Rice and Catherine Stockett and Jill McCorkle. I mean, that's just, I think it's awesome.
Yeah, so I mean, I've got the goosebumps when you just went and told me that again. It never gets never stops being a very strange feeling, you know, hearing that type of stuff. It's really, really nice. It's cool to hear. You never know. You know, you just kind of sit there and work for a long time and try to do your best, and you hope people like it. And then once you start hearing stuff from people that you really respect, you know, that's an awesome feeling.
And so now, are you a Southern Gothic storyteller?
You know, I have no idea. People say that, but I don't. I never like sit down and and think consciously about it. Do I want this story to be Southern Gothic? I just I think it's, you know, I'm from Louisiana and I write primarily about Louisiana, and I think that with this book particular, there's some dark stuff that happened, in terms of crime and all that type of stuff, and so I feel like it's, I feel like sometimes if you just write the place that it's from the South and there's themes that are dark, then it's Southern Gothic. You know, it's not definitely a conscious decision.
And so now you're working on another book, or you've actually finished another book that's going to be released pretty soon?
No, I have another book that came out a couple years before, a book of short stories called The Prospect of Magic. That came out with a smaller university press, I think 2010, but I'm actually looking back at that book and hoping to make some edits and give it another shot.
Okay, and now what about another novel?
Well, I've got some ideas that have been kind of, percolating for a while, but I've, since this book has come out, I've been, really busy, luckily, kind of touring and doing media stuff, so I haven't had that much time to think into it, but I teach at the University of New Orleans, and so I'm, my semesters are pretty jam-packed, so I'm looking forward to the summer to be able to sit down and finally get into it.
Do you think it'll take you 7 years to write the next one?
I would, I would actually be surprised if it took any less than that.
Really?
It's really hard to do. I don't think it's something that I don't know. I can't speak for other people, because obviously there are some people that put out a book a year, but to me it seems just a really kind of hard process. I'm just kind of a slow writer, I think, in general, with my process. I just do kind of constant revision, and I move forward pretty slowly, so. But who knows? Every time it's different, So maybe I'll just zip right through it. But to me, 7 years doesn't seem like that long.
Okay, fair enough. I'm just thinking that's a lot of updating to your website, though, between now and then. You know what? People are still going to want to know where you are and what you're doing, and they'll be reading your book, and,
I would love it if I felt like I could do something that was any good, in a shorter time than that. But, you just try to do your best.
And so I know that you're the director of the MFA program at the University of New Orleans. Do you think it's hard to teach writing and be a writer? And I ask that question kind of with the idea behind it that you're teaching what one should do, but when one sits down to write, what should happen often doesn't happen.
Right. I think that's different for different people. I mean, I've met some writers who had kind of teaching gigs, and they just felt like it kind of, sapped them, sapped all their energy. I don't feel that way at all, in a weird way. I mean, I really love teaching. I love talking about writing. I love being around, especially graduate students. So they're dedicating their lives to it, and they're all very talented and good. And I get kind of a certain amount of juice off of that. I like being reminded that it's important to people, and people care about it, and I also like kind of being held accountable for some of the things I'm saying. I mean, it's one thing for someone to go into a class and just kind of be a blowhard and say a bunch of really dynamic hardline stuff that's kind of hard to follow. But I also, I like to think about that stuff when I'm writing myself. It's like, it doesn't make any sense for me to go in there and tell people they're doing things wrong, and then I don't take that same kind of care with my own work. So I like it. I get energy out of it.
And Neil, what's your pitch for My Sunshine Away? Why should someone pick it up?
My pitch? Well, I don't know. That's hard to do. I'm sure you've heard every writer say it's we wouldn't work, write 300 pages if we could pitch it in one sentence. But I hope that, I would hope that it's a book that's, first and foremost, entertaining and enjoyable and not boring, but on the the larger scale, to me it seems a book of a lot about memory and kind of how we construct them and how we look at our past and ourselves and how we try to make ourselves, you know, better people, even through really hard circumstances.
Neil, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was great.
Linda Goodnight is the New York Times best-selling author of several romance series, and now she's the author of The Memory House, an inn in Tennessee that's brimming with secrets and possibilities. We started our conversation with me asking her to explain what The Memory House is all about.
I always think that's a hard question. And writers are told if they can't put their synopsis of their book on the back of a business card that they don't know what it's about. And I guess after about 50 books, I still don't know what my books are about because I've never been able to do that. But basically, The Memory House is a what's called a split-time novel, and I had no idea what that was when I first started writing it. But it's a dual storyline. One of the storylines takes place in the 1860s, and the other is current, contemporary. And the contemporary is actually the main part of the book. But the thing that ties the two stories together is the fact that they take place in the same antebellum house in rural Tennessee. And eventually those two stories converge and affect the past affects the present. And that sounds all boring, and so I'll just tell you.
It does not sound all boring, by the way, but go on, please.
My books are always about people. That's what characters are fascinating to me. And so basically this story is about two very wounded people. The heroine, Julia, who is the innkeeper of Peach Orchard Inn, has lost a child to an abduction. And the hero of the story, Eli, is a product of his own bad decisions. And he has come to this small town basically to start his life anew and to hide. He's ostracized from his family. And so that puts the two characters on a collision course. And what he wants to do is get his life back together, and what she wants to do is just to be able to keep on breathing every day without her lost son. And so the story is about how these two characters learn from each other, grow. Of course, I write romance, so eventually there's the romantic thread there. So basically that's what the story's about.
So now you have written primarily series before this book.
I have. I always have. I've written for Harlequin, for Love Inspired, Harlequin Romance, and Silhouette Romance. But The Memory House was a much bigger meatier book. I've been told that my series books are meatier than most series books, and I just felt the need to let those characters grow to their potential. And I love writing in the little parameters of series. I'm not saying that. But this allowed me that ability to really stretch and let my characters grow, and plus the dual storyline.
So when you were writing this book, when you set out to write The Memory House, which I guess could have had a totally different title at the beginning, did you know what you were doing? Did you know that you were writing this standalone book or this? Well, I guess it's not a standalone book, huh?
Well, it is. It will stand alone, but there are going to be some more books set in this inn and in this town of Honey Ridge, Tennessee. But this is a standalone book. But yes, I knew when I set out to write this that I was going to write a bigger, meatier book than my series books. This was intentionally developed for the single title market.
So was this based on some kind of decision that, you know what, I'm going to stretch my wings, or that you wanted, I don't know, I don't want to even lead you in that direction, so you tell me.
Yes, it was. it was based on realizing that I had always wanted to do that, and I'd been told for years that I could if I just would, and so I just decided to go for it. Several things had happened in my life that, in fact, I'd had a son tell me, because I was always saying to him, someday I'll do this, someday I'll do this. And he was very ill at the time, and he said, Mom, someday is now.
Yeah, very good point. Mm-hmm. So you said something very beautiful and eloquent a few minutes ago when you said when you lose a child, you know, you're still trying to figure out how to breathe. Where did this story idea come from?
It originated from a number of places, but I think that seed of the story began in the town where my son actually practiced medicine. A child was abducted about 20 years ago, and she's never been found. And I didn't realize that the story happened there until my son moved there, and his wife was telling me about it. And my mind just began to just whirl with what happens to families that never find their children. I mean, how do they go on? How do they get up every day and keep moving with the knowledge that maybe their child is out there somewhere? And so that's what got the idea started for the book. That's where I really began to think, this is something I want to explore. And then from there, it grew in lots of different directions. But that was the seed that started it.
So The Memory House was published at the end of March. I feel, though, that I have seen this book being publicized and talked about for many months before that. Like, people have been talking about The Memory House for quite a while. You had quite a bit of buzz build up before its release.
I hope so. I hope there's been a good buzz about it, and that it's finds new readers, because it is a stretch. It is a step outside what I have written in the past, and so it will take new readers. And Harlequin has been wonderful. HQN, which is my line, has really worked hard to do a good job to get the buzz out there. And I've been really blessed to have some good feedback and reviews, early reviews coming in on it. So yes, I'm really pleased about that and surprised. It surprised me, but I'm very happy. And so I'm glad you heard the buzz all the way.
I have. I was so shocked when I looked and saw that, you know, March 30th was the date of its release. But how are you feeling? I mean, you took this risk. I would think you took something of a risk in writing this new type of book. Mm-hmm. You know, are you feeling fabulous about it?
Nervous. I'm nervous that I loved the book. I was really happy with the book when I finished it. But it's like all authors say, when it's sort of akin to putting your baby out there in a beauty contest and hoping that everybody thinks that she's the prettiest one. And you don't know, because everybody has a different opinion. So it's exciting, but it's also nerve-wracking to wait and see what the early returns on. Or I guess it's sort of like people on Broadway. You know, they wake up and they look in Variety the next day to see how they did. And writers have to wait a lot longer than that to see how they did.
Though some never look. You know, some actors and some writers never, ever look at the reviews.
Yeah, that's true. And I generally don't unless someone sends it to me and says, hey, go over and look. And then once I do, it's sort of like, you know, the whole thing about watching a train wreck, then I can't look away.
Oh, my goodness. I hear you, though.
Yeah.
Well, you have a lovely website, which is lindagoodnight.com, which gives access and information about all of your books. It also includes a contact link. I imagine you hear from lots of readers.
I do. I get quite a bit of mail from readers, which is always so nice. I love my readers, and I am so humbled when anyone takes the time to write me a letter. And I save them all. I save everything, all my emails, all my messages through my website, the handwritten letters. I save all of those because they bless me and it's so much to know that someone took the time to do that. And it's incredible to a writer. I never forget who I write for. You know, I work for those people, and so I feel like they're my friends, and I love to hear from them.
That's a lovely way to think. And I see you're on social media. You're on Facebook. You're on Twitter. You're on Pinterest. You're on Goodreads.
I'm worn out.
Yeah, I bet just keeping up with social media is a full-time job.
It is. And I didn't have to do that back in the dark ages when I first started writing. And so it's a whole new world out there.
Linda, is there something that you want people to feel or experience when they read The Memory House?
I think that I write to entertain people. But I like to say I write feel-good fiction because even though my characters may have really dark, sad, difficult things they go through, and they do, I always want to leave on a hopeful, positive note. And so I like to leave that with my readers. I like for them, life is hard. You know, the world is tough out there. People have health problems, family problems, money problems, and you watch the news and you just want to hide. And life is hard. And so I want to write fiction that encourages people. And so when they get to the end of my book and they close that cover, they feel better. They feel hope. And even if it's just for those few hours they read the book, it's like, okay, the world really can work out okay.
I like that. I think I want to wrap things up right there. Thank you so much, Linda, for talking with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Win a copy of The Memory House by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. I'm so happy that all of you tuned in tonight to listen to the show. I'm also so happy to have had the opportunity to speak with such three terrific guests. So thank you to Linda Goodnight, thank you M.O. Walsh, and Nancy Bilyeu for spending some time with me and all of our listeners tonight. We'll be back again next Monday night with another great episode of the Literary New England Radio Show. Between now and then, you can read about all kinds of neat things that we have going on, different articles about New England-related authors and happenings by going to our blog site, which is at litnewengland.tumblr.com. We'll see you next week. Until then, have a great week and great reading.